You're listening to a program produced in 2017 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud. The journey of the coyote to the American West and beyond is one of the great epics of our time. Coyote America, the new and widely acclaimed book by Dan Flores, the A.B. Hammond Professor Emeritus of the History of the American West at the University of Montana, it's a really great read. It's a study that's part scientific, part mythological, and part personal observation. Flores, writer and former professor, was born and raised in Louisiana and is a longtime resident of the American West. He's also the author of American Serengeti, and Coyote America is now a finalist for the E.O. Wilson Science Award from Pan America. So we're very excited about that. Dan Flores is joined in conversation tonight by Melissa Cooper, an award-winning playwright, who will be interviewing him. Melissa's works have been produced around the country, and she is as well a chronicler of urban wildlife on her blog, Outwalking the Dog. Melissa lives in New York City, where she really did meet a coyote in Central Park. And before Melissa and Dan's conversation, we're going to begin tonight with an excerpt from Melissa's play, Coyote Existential, performed by the playwright and stage, TV, and film actor, Inger Tudor. Please welcome them to the stage. Thank you.
Thank you, Louise. We're delighted to be here. I just want to give you a brief context for this tiny excerpt, about 10 minutes, that you're going to hear of the play. I wrote this play in about 2011. In 2010, I actually saw a coyote in Central Park. And as Ishmael says of the white whale, the great floodgates of the wonder world swung open. I became fascinated, obsessed with the phenomenon of urban coyotes. And from that that obsession came NYC Coyote Existential, a play with songs and science. It's about two creatures, a woman and a coyote. The woman is Inger Tudor, I am the coyote, who are each in their own way looking for home. They encounter each other several times in Central Park, and the woman, who's come home to the city after a long time away, learns that the coyote has left its family to follow a dream of a lovely green island home, only to find itself smack in the middle of a very different island, Manhattan. So the scene that we're going to read begins with the woman alone on stage. She's in Central Park, as you can see, hoping to spot the coyote yet again and talk to it. And while she's waiting, she's talking to the audience and describing a few things in her life, including how walking her dog every day led her to discover, I'll let her tell it.
So out the dog and I went, twice a day, morning and evening, in good weather and bad, in the light and in the dark, down six flights and out into the city to walk for miles in the streets and parks. And that's how I discovered a separate world inside the world of the city, a parallel animal universe, breathing the same air as us, but following its own rules and rhythms and going about its own business all the time, all around us, whether we know it or not. Yes, smack in the heart of the city live raccoons, skunks, red-tailed hawks, kestrels, groundhogs, chipmunks, peregrine falcons. Coyotes, though? Coyotes never crossed my mind or my path. I grew up here. I know. We have no coyotes in Manhattan.
So what am I, chopped liver?
You. When I don't see you, you seem like a dream. Tell me, how are you making out in the city?
Still here?
That's good.
Island of Manhattan. It's not what I expected.
It's not easy, is it?
It's all right. Just too many dogs. You can't get away from them. Big dogs, little dogs, all dragging their people along on strings. It's terrible.
You don't like dogs?
I hate dogs. Hate dogs.
But you are a dog.
Feh. I am a coyote.
Coyote is a kind of dog.
Don't be ridiculous. I am not domesticated, demeaned, dependent.
You're still a dog. A Native American wild dog.
Says who?
Says science. I've been Googling you ever since the night we first met. You evolved right here in North America. You started coming east and north out of the Great Plains after the settlers went through at the end of the 19th century. You didn't even reach New York State until the 1920s.
I am not a fucking dog.
Okay, fine. I just thought you might be interested to know where you came from. The migrations of your ancestors, how you got to New York, the science of it all.
Can science tell me what's going to happen to me?
Maybe. What do you want to know?
Well, I want to know if I've found my island, my lovely green island. Can science tell me if this is my island?
I don't know.
Then screw science.
What?
Science is an asshole. Science is a jerk.
Science is not an asshole. What's the matter with you tonight?
What's the matter with me? I'm exhausted. That's what's the matter. The paths never empty. The streets never stop. When am I supposed to do my hunting and exploring? All day, all night, it's cars and dogs and people, people and dogs and cars. Honk, 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 trot, 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 sniff, sniff, piss, piss. 1 in the morning, 5 in the morning. What's the matter with me? What's the matter with you? What's the matter with this city? Doesn't anybody ever sleep around here?
It's the city that never sleeps.
Well, it's making me nervous. Oh, the big city kicks your ass, tells you all kinds of lies. Oh, 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 yeah, the big city kicks your ass. How you gonna survive? You sit down, you howl for your mama, heal your ass, give those streets one more time. Horns honk. Dogs bark, brakes screech, there's a rumble all night. Horns honk, dogs bark, brakes screech, there's a rumble all night. This living all alone in the city, oh, it's way harder than it should be tonight.
You found a good spot, though, didn't you? Yeah. Hallett Nature Sanctuary in the shadow of the Plaza Hotel. The only dog-free spot in all of Central Park, and you found it.
Hallelujah for Hallett. I sleep there all day. I slip out after dark. Oh, what passes for dark around here? Wait a minute. How do you know where I sleep?
It's hard to keep secrets in Manhattan.
Not for me.
It's a crowded island. No one goes unnoticed.
I keep to myself. I don't talk to anybody. Except you. I talk to you. Have you been telling people about me?
What? No, of course not. I would never. Well, maybe a little.
A little?
All right, I admit it. I talk about you all the time. I'm obsessed with you. Don't be mad. I can't help myself. I go to Gapstow Bridge at dusk and watch for you. I walk around Hallett's sanctuary every night hoping for a glimpse of you.
You're a stalker.
I see you slip out of the sanctuary at dusk. When the pond was frozen, you'd come right down onto the ice.
You saw that?
Now that it's melted, you have to hop the fence and trot across the little land bridge, and I can tell how hard it is for you, trying not to be seen by dog walkers and skateboarders.
You are creeping me out, woman.
Seeing you is the highlight of my day.
That's just pathetic.
No, it's not. It's exhilarating. It thrills me. A wild predator in Central Park. Don't you understand? It means anything is possible. The world just opens up and you... What?
Back off, sister.
But why? What did I say?
Keep your nose out of my business.
I'm not the only one that feels that way, you know.
Whoa, what's that supposed to mean?
You're a wildlife celebrity.
I am?
Oh, yes. People are tracking you, watching you, photographing you, blogging about you. You're in the New York Times.
What are they saying about me?
Different things. People wonder where you come from and where you're going. People like me are excited that you're here.
And the others?
Well, one man said it's the end of civilization.
Ha! Good!
No, that's not good.
Tremble, mankind, for the coyote is coming.
That is not a healthy attitude.
The coyotes come marching one by one. Hurrah, hurrah. The coyotes come marching one by one. Hurrah, hurrah. We're coming to eat your fucking cats and dogs and scare your kids and crap on your lawns. Dee, 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 dee.
Have you been going outside the park?
What? What are you talking about?
That was you and Chelsea last night, wasn't it?
Oh, how do you know about Chelsea?
I was hoping it was, I don't know, a different coyote, a stranger to me.
I want to know how you know.
What were you thinking? You can't leave the park. You can't go running through people's neighborhoods.
How do you know what I did last night?
It's on YouTube, for God's sake.
But that's my private life.
Do you know how lucky you are they didn't catch you? You have to be more careful. This is New York. Stay in the park.
I can't stay in the park. How can I find my island if I don't leave the park?
If you go running wild in the streets, they'll catch you and then...
Who's gonna catch me?
The authorities.
I'm a coyote, for crying out loud. I don't believe in authority.
This isn't about what you believe. This is about tranquilizer guns and catch poles and cages and rabies tests.
I exist outside your laws. No one can touch me.
Do you have any idea how they test for rabies?
I go where I please. I am on the move. I am ubiquitous.
I'm trying to help you.
I climb every mountain. I ford every stream. And now every state in the eastern seaboard has fallen to me, the coyote.
Listen to me.
This land is my land. This land is my land.
Stop singing.
From California to the New York Island.
Will you stop it?
From the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters.
Will you please listen?
And this land belongs to me, me, me! Yip, 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 boo! Thank you very much. So, Dan, care to come and join me? Dan Flores? I think, do we want to move these? Oh, they're moving. Okay, great. So this is The Wonderful Dan Flores. It's an extraordinary book. I know I'm not supposed to waste our time telling you that because we have a lot to cover, but it is absolutely fascinating. There's so much we can start with. But I wondered if you might start talking about the origins of the name Coyote. I've been saying coyote. We all know there's another pronunciation, coyote. And if you can just talk about both the etymology of the word, but also the political divide about pronunciation.
Yeah, that's one of the interesting things about the fact that we have two names for the animal in contemporary America is that it does kind of divide politically in terms of how people pronounce the name of this animal. But to sort of give you a sense of the antiquity of the name, coyote stems from an Aztec word from the Nahuatl language, and it's at least 1,000 years old, perhaps a little older than that, in fact. And in the Nahuatl language, it would be spelled C-O-Y-O-T-L, but the L is silent, mm-hmm. and so the pronunciation is coyote. So this was the word that the first Spanish settlers in Mexico, in the Southwest, and in California, when they confronted people who spoke that language, and that language was very widespread because of the reach of the Aztec Empire, this was the word they heard. But for most Americans, we didn't have in Europe any animal that was closely related to coyotes. Coyotes are a distinctively North American animal. They never migrated across the land bridges to Europe or Asia or Africa. And so Europeans didn't encounter this animal until we got to the American West. And the first Americans who really have an encounter are Lewis and Clark, who don't know exactly what the animal is. They think it's possibly a fox, but when they examine it closely, they realize it's some sort of small wolf. And so they name it a prairie wolf. And from 1804, really into the beginning of the 20th century, most Americans called coyotes prairie wolves. But when we began to settle the Southwest and started encountering Spanish speakers and Indian speakers who knew the Nahuatl word, the word either coyote from the Indians or coyote, as the Spanish had interpreted that word, entered American English. And by about 1870 or so, there began two different separate ways of saying the word. People from, most of them sort of literary types from the East Coast or from the West Coast, tended to follow the Spanish pronunciation and say coyote. And coyote is how we finally translated it into the 20th century. But there were a group of Midwestern and Southern mountain men in the Southern Rockies who heard that word in the 1840s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and they simplified it just to coyote. And so people in the South and the Midwest began using that term. And it finally became, in our own time, something of a political division where if you respected the animal, you called it a coyote. And as a friend of mine has said, anybody who shoots one, traps one, poisons one, never calls it a coyote. It's always a coyote. And so we've ended up then with two different pronunciations that often kind of have a political dimension.
It's fascinating. So you've encountered coyotes or coyotes pretty much your whole life. You grew up in Louisiana, right?
That's true.
You have a wonderful, you open the whole book with a wonderful description of a coyote encounter. Would you mind reading that for us?
Sure, I'd love to read that.
Yeah.
These in fact are the opening passages of Coyote America. And the book begins like this. Here is a vivid memory. I'm on winter break from my university duties, and I'm home visiting my parents in Louisiana. We're up early, stirring around in the kitchen on a gray, misty dawn in our hometown near the Black Bayou in the north of the state. My dad knows the paper will already be in the mailbox, and he asked me to walk out to the end of the driveway to fetch it in. I'm in the act of pulling the Shreveport Times out of the box in silvery blue twilight, when I hear a rhythmic clatter and the scratching of toenails on the asphalt street. Plastic-wrapped newspaper in hand, I turn towards the commotion and find myself staring into the face of a coyote, which shoots me a quick sidelong glance as it passes by mere feet away, rocking along in that characteristic lope with which coyotes go through the world. Close enough to pepper my ankles with dislodged gravel as it digs in to swerve past me. I register hot yellow eyes and something in its mouth. Maybe it's the neighbor's cat, although in the dim light, it looks more like a trio of tall boys dangling from plastic six-pack rings. Open mouth, I follow its course down the street when a second coyote appears, weaving through three parked cars parked on the road opposite my parents' home. Pink lung, tongue lolling, this one fixes me with a look that has something of a been good to know you wave as it passes. And in another couple of seconds, it's at the corner intersection at the end of the block. There it pauses for an instant, turns to look back at me, and then is gone in a movement I barely discern, like smoke dispersed by a sudden swirl of wind. Coyote number two seems empty-handed, and I register the thought and tell my dad back in the kitchen, those look like pull-tab beers anyway, so no bottle opener needed after all.
I love that section. I love opening the book with it because it actually touches on so many things that I hope we can touch on some of, you know, tonight, including, and we'll get back to this, issues of coyote intelligence, curiosity, interaction with humans, pair bonds, you know, family, so many things. But I'm stuck right now on the fact that it was Louisiana. Okay. I mean, we think of coyotes as, you know, traditionally we think of them as animals of the Great Plains, right? And now, as you saw in the piece I read, they're turning up in Manhattan, they're all over LA. And here's a coyote in Louisiana. You talked about in the book about coyotes having their being truly American because they have their own manifest destiny. but can you tell us a little bit about how this came to pass? Just set the stage a little bit that they're, how or why they've spread across the continent in this way.
Well, so we're dealing with an animal whose evolutionary origins were in the American West 5.3 million years ago. This is an ancient American creature. The entire canid family, in fact, evolved in North America out of this line. But while animals like jackals, wild dogs, dingoes, gray wolves, all ended up leaving North America, spreading around the world via the land bridges that connected North America to the rest of the world's continents, coyotes never left. They stayed here. And so, I mean, one of the arguments I make in this book is that this is such a distinctively American animal that in a lot of ways, it serves as an avenue to becoming more American ourselves the more we know about it. I mean, its origins and its biography are exclusively here in our part of the world. And so it evolves into its present form about 800,000 years ago. Its range confined from the Great Plains westward to the Pacific coast, although, and into this part of California, but not from Northern California up the Pacific coast. It was confined to east of the mountains in that part of the West. But starting at some point around 1,000 years ago, it began expanding its range, basically drawn by human activity. It's an animal that has been living with humans for probably 15,000 years. I mean, this is an animal that, as people migrated out of Africa to North America 15,000 years ago, out of Siberia to here, they found coyotes here. And so coyotes fairly quickly took our measure and realized that it was not bad to hang out with us. In fact, it was a very good thing. We tended to generate the kind of prey that coyotes like. Rats and mice love human habitations. Mm-hmm. And so coyotes began hanging out close to human settlements. And they began expanding their range southward about 1,000 years ago, all the way down into the vicinity of Mexico City, which is how the Aztecs came to know about them. And then as Europeans began arriving 500 years ago, coyotes began tracking the movements of people across North America. As fur traders and miners, for example, went into Canada and into the far north and into Alaska, coyotes, we have good records, followed their movements northward. As people driving herds of goats and sheep began to colonize the southern valleys of Mexico and down into Central America, coyotes tracked southward there until eventually they were 7,000 miles north and south, which was about a doubling of their original range. And then beginning in the 19th century, they began moving not only westward across the mountains to the Pacific coast, but they began moving eastward into the Great Lakes and beyond. And through much of the 20th century, they were colonizing the South and the East. And as I grew up in Louisiana in the early 1960s, at the age of 14, I suddenly found myself surrounded by coyotes. And I think I probably started writing this book at that point in time.
Fascinating. That's great. You know, I was going to, let me ask you already to read another section. When you're talking about being a teenager in Louisiana, and you've, Louise mentioned in the introduction, this kind of war on predators that has gone on and so on. If you would just read that, you know the section, I mean.
I do.
It's a powerful section.
Well, I will read this section and you will understand what Melissa means when she says it's something that at least was a powerful experience for me. Standing on my patio in the ancient coyote range outside Santa Fe, with coyote howls enlivening almost every night in the high desert of New Mexico, I wonder now at the mindset of this biography and our role in it, the mode of thinking that makes us such stoic killers, able to extinguish with such ease the very qualities that lend the world beauty, grace, romance. And to my personal regret, I wonder not just how it played out a century ago or in other minds. I wonder about it in all of us, certainly in myself, who as a teenager, when coyotes were colonizing Louisiana, tried so hard to possess wild nature and bring it to hand. This is an uncomfortable memory for me, but here it is. It's an early daybreak with the sun a flattened red ball through the mist of the Red River Valley. I'm 17 years old. A coyote pauses in yellow prairie grass, her muzzle wondrously sharp and refined, her ears working. Dew droplets cascade into silvery pearls in the air above her as her tail switches the grass. Her intense eyes bore straight into mine. She is posing an ancient question, one I will not be capable of answering correctly until another decade of living has passed. So, a rifle blast shatters the humid morning air, and she yelps, spins, disappears. The next moment is one of the most vivid mind's eye pictures of my life, as perfect in my memory as a circle. The sun suddenly breaks through the mist, and all that only an instant before had seemed wild, romantic, beautiful, dissolves in stop-frame motion as I look on. The prairie becomes a scraggly pasture littered with cow dung and discarded plastic soft drink bottles and broken farm machinery. The wilderness is now encircled with a half-collapsed barbed wire fence decorated with rusted, bullet-riddled, no trespassing signs. And somewhere beyond the cottonwoods along the river, the gears of a propane delivery truck are grinding like chalk on slate. In an instant, I had personally recapitulated the last 200 years of coyote history. I had destroyed what I loved, drained beauty and perfection from the world with a syringe as I looked on, detached, stoic, a killer.
Mm. So, yeah, it's quite a section. Can you talk a little bit about those last 200 years of coyote killing that are still going on? I mean, and what I'd like to hear about that a little bit, but then segue that into talking about how an animal that is so persecuted is so successful. Why haven't we eradicated them? We eradicated the wolf.
Indeed we did.
So if we can talk a little bit about that, I think it's pretty fascinating.
Well, the biography of this animal is a true roller coaster ride. I mean, we have 15,000 years nearly of adoration of coyotes as a sacred animal. In fact, as a deity responsible for creating North America as we know it. This, of course, in the minds of the native people. And then beginning about 200 years ago, from the Lewis and Clark expedition onward, when we Euro-Americans began to encounter these animals because they're unfamiliar to us at first. I mean, we arrive from Europe with all sorts of stories, folk tales, preconceptions about wolves, mm-hmm. about bears. But coyotes, we don't know exactly what to make of them for much of the 19th century. And one of the stories I tell in the book is how it really takes Mark Twain in his bestseller, Roughing It, published in 1872, to provide a description of the coyote as a dastardly, weaselly little coward, a little vermin that deserves to be exterminated, that gives Americans finally a way to think about this animal. And the conclusion we draw from Twain's widely read and disseminated book is that this is not an animal that actually deserves existence in North America. And so we resolve, and especially a government agency called the Bureau of Biological Survey that comes to position itself in American history as the solution to the predator problem for the livestock industry, resolves that once wolves are taken care of, which, and that, by the way, doesn't take very long at all. We began working on wolf eradication in the 1870s, and American gray wolves are basically gone by the 1920s.
Amazing.
But coyotes, despite the fact that we had been poisoning and trapping and bountying and killing them by the tens and hundreds of thousands year after year, all over that same stretch of time that wolves were disappearing, somehow coyotes didn't seem to disappear. I tell the story, in fact, in the book of a very famous article written by Ernest Thompson Seton in Scribner's Magazine in 1900, trying to explain why all these other animals were disappearing and coyotes didn't. I won't tell you that story now, but I'll encourage you, if you pick up the book, to read it. It's a very fascinating allegorical tale of why coyotes don't disappear. But what basically happens is that by 1931, with wolves dispatched, this government agency convinces Congress to pass a bill called the Animal Damage Control Act that designates coyotes as a creature that we are going to completely eradicate from the face of the earth. And we create a government lab called the Eradication Methods Lab to invent poisons to exterminate coyotes. And Congress passes this bill, which gives the Biological Survey $10 million over 10 years to exterminate coyotes. And all during the 1930s, I mean, they engage in the most extraordinary scorched earth effort to wipe coyotes out that you can possibly imagine. I won't go into all the details of this, but I'll simply tell you that what had transfixed a writer like Ernest Thompson Seton back in 1900 and now left the hunters of the Biological Survey completely flabbergasted was that coyotes not only didn't disappear, but suddenly they began expanding their range and their population all over North America. And what we think happened is that coyotes had co-evolved alongside gray wolves and had evolved a number of evolutionary adaptations that enabled them to survive intense pressure and harassment. And so it wasn't that they evolved their ability to survive because of us. They had evolved these abilities by co-evolving with wolves and now found that it was possible to translate this into a way to evade destruction by every kind of means we could throw at them. I mean, I'll just give you a couple of examples that I talk about in the book. One is that coyotes, one of the things they're doing when they're howling is they're taking a census of coyote populations. And when they don't hear howls coming back, when they sense that the population is low, because their numbers are regulated by resources that are out there, then they have larger litters. And so as their numbers are suppressed by harassment, they have larger litters to compensate and to keep their numbers up to the level of the resources that are available. And the other adaptation that they have that's really critical is called fission fusion. And it's a very unusual adaptation that very few large mammals in the world have. We happen to be a mammal that also has this same evolutionary adaptation. And that helped enable our survival at several times in our biological history. And what it means is that coyotes and humans are animals that can survive as social units, in the case of coyotes, as packs. But if they're harassed and pressed, they can also scatter across the landscape as singles and pairs and survive that way, in a way that sometimes large pack animals like wolves can't. Mm-hmm. And so coyotes were able to use this fission fusion adaptation to not only survive our attempt to eradicate them, but to end up, in fact, in places like Central Park. So one of the great ironies of this biographical story of this animal is that our attempt to eradicate it is one of the primary reasons why it's in every major city in the United States now.
Unbelievable. I mean, it's such a fascinating story. I was telling Dan about going on right now is a story unfolding in Queens, New York, that fits right in with what you're saying, I would think, both in terms of the coyotes finding their way to Queens, but it was the first breeding pair in Queens. And it was parents, because the coyotes, I want you to talk about their pack life, their family life as well. But so it was both the parents, and they had, I think, 8 or 9 pups. So I'm imagining that they sent up their howls in Queens and didn't get a lot back. So unfortunately, those pups, all except one, have all been caught and euthanized because people are terrified of them, which will be something else we can talk about. If we don't get to it right here, please ask lots of questions when we get to that point. But let's talk a little bit about coyote lifestyle, coyote culture, as you pointed out, their life in a pack is very different than a wolf pack, and sort of how do they function? And the coyotes we see around in Los Angeles, how do they live together?
Well, they do tend to establish packs, although one of the things biologists argue as evidence that they're not nearly as keyed to pack life and social life as wolves are, is that coyotes have far fewer facial expressions in communicating with one another than wolves do. Wolves are pretty exclusively pack animals, and so they have a lot of expressions that they exchange. Coyotes have fewer expressions, and so they do have this kind of plasticity that enables them to move between being a pack group with a territory, a defended territory, mm-hmm. or sometimes just a single or a pair of animals. The packs commonly consist of two breeding alpha animals, two adult animals, and often the pups of a couple of previous years. And so when you see a pack of coyotes run across the road or run through a pasture, I mean, usually what you're seeing, I mean, I get to see this fairly frequently at my home outside Santa Fe, New Mexico, because there is a particular alpha pair, and I know it's the same pair because the female has a white tip on her tail, mm-hmm. which is fairly unusual for coyotes. They usually have black tips. And this particular alpha male and female come through the yard on a regular basis. And behind them, the two alphas usually are in the lead, and behind them are often animals that I think when most of us will see a coyote, I've heard people say, that animal I saw was, I mean, it looked like it weighed 25 pounds. Yeah. It was scrawny. And what you're seeing is a young 6 to 8 month old animal. It's not a fully adult animal. And those are the ones you mostly see. Coyotes are like us. The animals that you see the most and that make the most mistakes and get in the most trouble are the young ones, and it's usually the young males. those are the ones that we commonly encounter. And so that's how a pack is usually constituted. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that also explains their ability to survive our harassment is that when we take out the alphas, coyotes have the ability, which wolves don't, for the beta females to come into heat and begin to breed at a year of age. And so when you take out the older alpha animals, which often provide the culture, which often know how to keep the pack out of trouble, that they know not to attack mm-hmm. sheep, not to attack livestock, you take out the alpha animals, and then you have young animals that don't know any better, and sometimes females that are only a year old that are breeding and having pups. And so you create a kind of a disrupted coyote culture. Mm-hmm. And part of our inability, I think, to grapple with these animals is that we don't understand that when you leave them alone, and we have great examples of this from Yellowstone National Park, where for 75 years, from the 20s until the 1990s, not only were people not harassing coyotes, but there were no gray wolves in Yellowstone either. And what we got to observe there across those decades were coyotes establishing territories, defending them, their populations stable, never rising above the level of the resources that were out there. And so you have this very stable population of animals. And as soon as gray wolves were introduced into Yellowstone and began harassing and killing coyotes and digging up their dens and killing their pups, they began going into this colonization mode, trying to keep their population up. So we've gotten an example of it right in our own time to witness.
That's so fascinating. So speaking of how we're interacting with coyotes and all of this, you mentioned earlier, of course, that the Native American previous and after the European settlers came had been living with coyotes for a very, very long time. You want to talk a little bit more about how the Native Americans in North America viewed coyotes, what role the coyote had in mythology and religion?
Yeah, this was a very fun part of this book to do. In fact, I will say, I've never done a book that was as fun to do as this, because I've never encountered a species, perhaps other than us, that has a story like the coyote does. And certainly one of the most fascinating parts of the story is the fact that, and this is something it seems to me we don't give enough credence to, the oldest literary canon we have in North America are the coyote stories that were preserved by Native people through their oral traditions for probably 10,000 years of time. I mean, and there were absolutely hundreds of them. They were preserved for thousands of years, finally collected by folklorists and ethnographers, at the beginning of the 20th century, and so set down in print for all of us to be able to read and to share. And what we realize about these stories, I know you've all heard about them, many of you have probably read them. We think of them as trickster stories, but I argue in Coyote America that in a way that has marginalized what these coyote stories really are. Because the part of the coyote story that you have to understand is that although some of them, to be sure, are about tricks, the important part is not the trick, it's why the trick works. So here's what I mean by that. What these stories are about are assessing human nature and why we humans do the things we do, why we act the way we act, why we make the decisions that we make. And what coyote represents is this avatar figure, this stand-in for humanity. And when you read his stories, what you recognize is that he functions as this classic deity figure who stands in time far in advance or in depth of time, farther back than, say, our contemporary religious figures, like for Jesus of Nazareth, for instance, is a figure whose perfection we're all supposed to try to emulate. But Coyote, as a Paleolithic deity existing thousands of years farther back in time, makes no attempt at being a perfect figure. In fact, he displays every aspect of human nature, both our good qualities and our bad qualities. And it's usually the bad qualities that are on display because they're the most instructive ones. And so Coyote appears as a narcissist, a buffoon, a fool, but the stories are always intended to display proper conduct, usually by following the format, don't do what this idiot does. And so they're funny, they're poignant, and they grapple with all the great, I mean, they're like Greek tragedies in many ways because they grapple with all the aspects of the human condition. I mean, I call the chapter that I do on this Old Man America because that's what, to me, these stories are.
Fantastic. So, with that preamble, will you tell us one story, a condensed version of a story?
Well, I tell four Coyote stories in my chapter, Old Man America. And I can tell you it was very, obviously, a difficult thing to try to decide which stories to tell. But the four I selected because they illustrated the argument I was just making, that these stories are they're an attempt to explain human nature to us.
They're quite a range, those stories you chose.
They are quite a range, that's
From
right.
From flying vaginas and things to what we'll hear now, so it's quite a range.
You got in flying vaginas, thank you. Yeah.
Couldn't resist.
Yeah, okay, well, I won't tell you that one.
You'll have to read the book for that one.
Yeah, you'll have to read the book for that one. So a story I'll tell you just briefly as an example. For Native people, Coyote was responsible, as I said, for creating the North American continent, for making the rivers flow where they flowed, for putting the mountain ranges where they were, for locating various tribes in particular places where Coyote had killed monsters and made it possible for human beings to live. But they were about so many other things, and one of the things that several of the stories are about is why there is death and why we can't return from death. And so one of the stories that I told, this is a Nez Perce story, and by the way, what I did with these stories was I took the original ethnographic accounts of them and then wrote them in my own prose, in modern prose. And this particular story was called, it's a Nez Perce story, it was called Coyote and the Shadow People. And it's a story that attempts to explain why there's death in the world and why we can't return from it. And according to the Nez Perce and the Navajos and the Yanas of California and several other groups, it was Coyote who created death, which he thought was a necessity. But Coyote didn't think so when he had to experience death himself. And so in this story, Coyote is happily married. He loves his wife very much, but one day she takes ill, and within a few days she dies. And Coyote, who has introduced death into the world, now decides this was a horrible idea. And he wails and screams and beats his breast and acts, as the story says, like a crazy man. And then he's visited by a spirit called the death spirit. And the death spirit says, Coyote, if you will do exactly what I say, and I mean exactly what I say, I will make it possible for you to see your dead wife. So Coyote says, I'll do anything. Of course I will do exactly as you say. And Death Spirit admonishes him and said, now you know how you are, Coyote. You're not good at taking directions. But Coyote says, I will do exactly as I promise, I promise. And so Death Spirit begins to take him on a journey. And Coyote says, he can barely see this death figure. I mean, he's just almost invisible. But he can track this sort of smoky, filmy figure through the landscape. And the death spirit says, Coyote, look out across the prairies. See those running horses. Don't you think those are beautiful, wild horses? And Coyote strains his eyes. He doesn't see a thing. But he says, well, yeah, sure. I guess those are great horses. Those are fantastic horses running across the prairie. And the death spirit says, look at these service berries. Eat some. These are wonderful. And Coyote pretends to grab a bough of service berries and eat them, just as the death spirit says. So the journey goes on for about 3 days, and finally they come to a big open plain. And the death spirit says, Coyote, sit down here on the ground and wait until night falls. Because in this place I've taken you to, when night falls, day is coming in the world of the spirits. And so Coyote sits in the plain and he waits as instructed. And as it begins to get dark, he begins to hear voices. He begins to smell fires being started. He begins to see figures moving about. And soon he realizes he's in a world, in a longhouse, as he calls it, of other people. And he realizes sitting beside him on the ground is his wife. And so he's overjoyed. And he spends the entire day with her, wandering around to the camps, talking to others, enjoying the company of his wife. He is completely thrilled. And then, as the day begins to pass, the sun comes up for Coyote, and he finds himself sitting out in the middle of the prairie. And everyone is gone. But the death spirit says, you stay here all day long, right where you are. Coyote sits there in the broiling sun, burning up. But the death spirit tells him not to move. And so the same scene happens again at the next turn of the sun. And once again, he's with his wife. So this happens 4, 5, or 6 times. And finally, the death spirit comes to him and says, Coyote, now I am going to make it possible for you to take your wife back home to the world of the living. You'll have to journey for 5 days and you'll cross 5 mountains. My only directive to you is this, and you know how you are, Coyote. Pay attention to what I say. You have to follow these instructions. You cannot touch your wife until you pass the 5th mountain on the last day of your journey. At that point, she will be well and whole and alive again, and you will have established the principle of bringing someone back from the dead. And so Coyote says, of course, I will do exactly as you say. And he and his wife start out on the journey. On the first day, he can barely even see her. She's just a mist beside him. But as the journey goes on, each day, she becomes a little more visible to him. So that by the 3rd day, he can really see her distinctly. And on the fourth day, with only one mountain left to cross, Coyote wakes up, sees his wife sitting across the camp from him. She is so beautiful and so young, he simply can't help himself. And he jumps up and runs to her and throws his arms around her. And as he is in the act of doing so, she screams, "Coyote, no, no!" And as he touches her, she disappears. And at that point, the death spirit, of course, shows up, angry, and says, "You realize you have just screwed up how we were going to make the world work. It was going to be possible to return from death, and now you've messed it up. People are about to come, and now they're never going to be able to do this." So Coyote, of course, he's dejected beyond belief, but he has an idea. And so he starts back on the journey that he had taken with Death Spirit. He comes to the plain where the wild horses were supposed to be running across the grass, and he strains to see them, and he remarks aloud, "What a beautiful herd of wild horses." He comes to the place where the service berries were growing, and he gets big handfuls and eats them in his imagination. And then he goes to the very spot, finally, where when the sun had gone down that first day, he had found himself sitting beside his wife and sat there on the ground and waited to hear the sound of voices, waited to smell the campfires. And Coyote sat there all night long. And the next morning, when the sun came up, he found himself sitting out in the middle of an open prairie alone. And that was the end of the story.
It's a great story.
Thank you.
So on that note, we're going to start to open up to questions from the audience. In the interest of time, there will be microphones roving among you. I'm going to just ask you a question that maybe can start to turn into some audience things. But having to do, you mentioned death, I think an area of death, to take it in a very different direction, that is on many people's minds is that of their pets with regard to Coyote. So I know that's a sort of a huge issue in certain communities. Is coyotes eating? Are they eating my cat? Are they, et cetera? Can you talk a little bit about what we know about that?
Well,
and then we do want to go to questions.
Yeah, that's of course a question that's of concern to a lot of people, because coyotes are among us, among all of us now. They are in every town, every city in the United States. So everyone is living with them, and there's nothing, by the way, we can do about it. Resistance is futile. They are here among us, and so it's our task to figure out how to coexist with them. And one of the ways we have to coexist with them, of course, is to protect our animals, because they're wild predators. They establish territories, and they defend those territories against other predators. And so their interest in your dogs and your cats usually is based on either one of two things. It's either that your dog or cat has entered their territory and they regard it as an invading, competing predator that they need to drive away, which is why they will sometimes kill dogs and cats but not eat them. And the other thing, of course, they're concerned about is when they're making dens and raising pups, they're concerned about dogs especially being a threat to their pups. And so, I mean, I spend a good deal of time in Coyote America trying to help people grapple with how to coexist in modern America with coyotes by helping folks understand what coyote natural history is. When they have their pups, what season of the year, how they react to your presence with a dog, what you should do and I do it primarily by describing my own experience with my dog in this very circumstance, and of course encouraging people, as we do with our cat, not letting it outside, especially at night when coyotes are out hunting. And so it just requires that extra step that, okay, we haven't had to go through before because coyotes might not have been on the block, but now they are, and now you have to take that extra step in order to make everything go smoothly. Because coyotes are good citizens if you give them a chance to be so.
But they don't take direction.
That's right.
So, questions?
Hello. You mentioned that by howling, coyotes take a census. So I'm wondering if you know, when they hear the ambulances, they sometimes react. Are they counting, or does that just mess them up?
I haven't heard that question before.
That's great.
I think they're being encouraged to howl because the siren is a related sound. And no, I don't think they're doing a census of ambulances in greater L.A. or anything. That's interesting, though. Yes.
Is this on? Yes. Okay, great. Could you describe a little bit about the hunting habits, the techniques that coyotes use? Do they hunt solo? Do they hunt in packs? Do they use deception sometimes to capture their prey? And what's their favorite prey? What do they mostly prey on?
Yeah, I'll start with the last part of that. They're actually omnivores, and so they certainly love to catch mice and rats. That's one of the reasons they're drawn to being among us, is because we produce so many rats and mice as part of our settlements. But they're omnivores, and so they eat a lot of fruit, a lot of vegetables, a lot of plant material. Right now in the Southwest, in New Mexico, for example, I mean, we've been tracking the coyote appearances through the yard by the mounds of juniper berries in their droppings, because they are basically eating almost exclusively juniper berries in the fall and winter. So they're not just pure carnivores. In terms of their hunting strategy, they hunt larger animals in packs, but everything from basically jackrabbits on down, jackrabbits, cottontails, rats, mice, and so forth, that's usually an individual coyote pursuit. I mean, they'll sometimes, of course, coyotes will be going through a landscape as a pack, and a jackrabbit will jump up, and so they will take off in pack pursuit. But they tend to preserve the pack strategies for larger animals, often the fawns of white-tailed deer and mule deer and things like that. And they tend to take down animals like that with a neck grab, and they try to collapse the windpipe of those animals. I mean, this has been a very interesting phenomenon to observe in terms of our modern attempts to kill coyotes for the livestock industry, because the only place that it's possible anymore to use compound 1080 as a poison is in neck collars for sheep, so that only a coyote attacking a sheep that has a 1080 collar on it gets poisoned. Coyotes, within about 3 or 4 years of the invention of the sheep neck collar, began to perfect the technique of dragging sheep down by their hindquarters.
Incredible.
And avoiding the 1080 collar. I mean, they have culture, and so they teach these things to their pups.
Yeah, sounds very much like another species we know in adaptability and culture and so on.
Indeed.
I have read that coyotes have mated with wolves, particularly in the Northeast. Is that correct?
It is correct. So here's an interesting story for you that has to do with the evolution of canids in North America. You will never hear the story of coy wolves in the West, where we have coyotes and gray wolves. They do not hybridize. The only place we're hearing the story of coyotes and wolves hybridizing is in the South and the East, among populations of wolves that we believe are animals that, like coyotes, are wolf species that never left North America and therefore are much more closely related to coyotes than gray wolves are, which ended up 2.5 million years ago, going to Asia and Europe and then not returning to North America until about 25,000 years ago. But meanwhile, in North America, we maintained a couple of populations of wolves, which we now call the red wolf of the South and the eastern wolf. And those wolves are closely enough related to coyotes that there are no behavioral barriers to prevent them from hybridizing. And so when they encounter one another, they hook up. And so we have an emerging population. It's probably not huge, but it's an emerging population of animals, especially in the Northeast now, that is about 75% coyote genetically and about probably 18 to 20% eastern wolf with another admixture of domestic dog. And so it's a coyote that basically, it's an animal that has all the smarts and intelligence and adaptability and resilience of the coyote, but it's a little bit bigger, and it has some of the ability of eastern wolves to exist in this timbered, heavily forested, deer prey kind of habitat in the Northeast. It's kind of a new animal for our time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Really remarkable thing that's happening. But the origins of it seem to have to do with this long-term evolution of canids in North America.
Has the coyote population continued to grow in urban centers like Los Angeles? It seemed like a few years ago it seemed to be booming. I can't tell if it's now more stabilized. Do you have a theory
on
that?
I can't tell you whether it's growing now. I'm just not sure. I will say that the biologists who have been studying the coyote populations in places like Los Angeles, Seth Riley in particular, and the guy who studies coyotes in Chicago, Stan Gert is his name. I know that Stan Gert believes that the coyote population in Chicago at this point, and this may be the case in Los Angeles, this is why I bring him up, has reached a point where it's pretty much saturated the available resource base. And so coyote populations in Chicago are now providing animals that are colonizing outside the city that, I mean, are actually seeking territories away from greater Chicago. And that could be what's happening in Los Angeles. One of the fascinating things to me about Los Angeles is that Los Angeles seems to have had coyotes all along, forever. I mean, I found the account of an American explorer who was in California in the 1840s, and he wasn't in Los Angeles at this particular, with this description. He was actually on the Central Coast in Monterey, Carmel, but he described coyotes running through town like dogs, he said, in Monterey and Carmel in the 1840s. And I know that coyotes were in Los Angeles as far back as the 19-teens. By 1939, there was a bounty program on them in the city. Something like 600 of them were killed in the first bounty collection in 1939. I mean, Walt Disney began doing films about coyotes in the Hollywood Hills in the 1960s. So coyotes have been in L.A. all along. I mean, their populations, you know, sometimes ebb and flow for reasons that we're not quite sure. And so we may be in a time when they're a little suppressed at the moment.
Two more questions.
Oh, good evening. Wonderful evening you've provided us. I was wondering, because, you know, we're familiar with animal whispers. I wonder, has anybody on the planet really tried to do that type of interaction with a coyote? We live up in the Hollywood Hills near Griffith Park, and there are constantly coyotes coming down to our street. And oftentimes I give eye contact, and there's great eye contact.
Oh, yeah.
And just great love and respect for these animals. And I wish we could talk, you know. And
yes.
I wonder, has there been any type of research where there have been that type of study or that type of attempt at interacting and communicating?
You know, I'm not aware of anything quite like that. I mean, there are all sorts of tantalizing tales. I mean, you're right. They make wonderful eye contact with you. You know, they will look right into the depths of your soul, and then after a moment get bored and yawn in your face. But, yeah, they have this remarkable ability. You know, sometimes dogs will divert their gaze. They won't look at you, but coyotes will look right into your eyes. I mean, I tell the story in the epilogue of the book of a very fun performance art that a German artist named Joseph Beuys performed in New York in 1974 in an attempt to help the United States get over its Vietnam War blues. And he called his performance art, "I Like America and America Likes Me." And what he was referring to by America was a coyote that he engaged in a kind of a dance with as part of his performance. And this coyote, America, and the YouTube exists. I have, in fact, in my bibliography, I'll give you the site for it so you can go and watch it. This coyote, and it's a wild animal, but it engages with him in a kind of a remarkable way. He throws a glove up in the air for it to catch, and it bounces around him. And in the end, supposedly, it actually let him put his hand on it. But Joseph Beuys ended up going back to Germany convinced that he had helped cure the United States of its Vietnam problem by engaging with a coyote named America. And so look up "I Like America and America Likes Me." And it is a really wonderful thing.
We could probably use something like that right now, a different variation.
We need to do this again, don't we?
Yeah, right.
Hi, thank you so much. I know you mentioned that with your book, you're trying to educate people about the history of the coyote to help them coexist with them. And despite, I guess, us talking about the maybe slight suppression of the population in Los Angeles, I can assure you, in my parents' neighborhood of the deep San Fernando Valley, they're not even in the mountains, actually. They're just in the suburbs of Northridge. There are probably daily coyote sightings from neighbors, and they have this, like, neighborhood email that goes around of, like, you know, oh, whose dog got attacked or cat was taken away or whatever. And so I think people are well aware of, like, don't leave your animal in the yard by itself.
Yeah.
But the other day, there was a woman with a Mastiff puppy, but I think, you know, a Mastiff puppy is not the size of a normal puppy. And three coyotes came and attacked her with the dog. And luckily, the dog wasn't killed. And I guess I'm wondering if there's one takeaway from your book. Like, I don't think I can get this whole, you know, group of people to read it, but I'd love to be able to pass something on to them as far as, like, you know, we talk about with mountain lions to make noise, or I don't know if there's, like, some takeaway of, like, how can we deal with the coyotes.
Yeah. thank you very much for asking that.
Yeah.
What I think the takeaway is that these are wild animals, and we need to make sure that they stay wild. Usually when they get into trouble and they do things like what you just described, it's because they've become habituated to being around people for one reason or another. Either people haven't tried to frighten them away, shout at them, or people actually, and of course this happened a lot in Los Angeles back in the 1980s when there was a spate of people being bitten by coyotes, folks were feeding coyotes in their yards. And it ended up producing a kind of an epic number of bites. And so you have to keep them thinking about us that basically we're just kind of almost too weird for them to trust. And so you do strange things. You shout at them and run at them. And if you've got a good arm and they're hanging out too close and you don't want them around your house that close, throw a rock at them. But they have to remain wild, because when they get into trouble is when they feel too habituated and too calm around people. And so I think that's probably the best advice I could give for that.
I think that's all we have time for in terms of questions. Is that right?
Dan, and thank our visiting coyote, Melissa, for your excerpt and Inger. Thank you all for coming, and keep coyotes weird.
That's great.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information. 17.